because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward together. That's exactly where we're going to go.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This is Rewind, Wisconsin Eye's look at the news this week. J.R., let's put it in the front. Yes. Neither of us are lawyers.
Yes.
But we have to spend a great part of the show talking about lawsuits and judicial rulings. So a disclosure, neither of us are mm-hmm. lawyers. Okay. But then last night, mm-hmm. Judge Adelman, a federal judge in Milwaukee, threw out the Cindy Archer lawsuit. Now, we got to go slow on these things because there's so many Jundo 1, Jundo 2s. So, What had she alleged? What had she sued over?
She accused John Chisholm, the Milwaukee County DA, his top deputies and investigators in his office, of basically malicious prosecution. They targeted her because she helped Governor Walker push through Act 10. Now, Chisholm Company said that's not the case. You were looked at because of your activities as Governor Walker's, one of his top aides in his Milwaukee County administration. They looked at things like a contract with a county building, all these things, that there was something fishy going on, never charged her. Right. But after she moved, after she came to Walker's administration in Madison, her home was raided. They collected evidence. They interviewed her. And after all this kind of went down, she sued, saying you guys were in the wrong. Adelman last night ruled essentially that these guys have immunity from this lawsuit.
D.A. Chisholm.
D.A. Chisholm
and his
company.
Staff.
He called it a textbook example of why prosecutors have to have this immunity because otherwise, if you allow these kind of lawsuits to go forward, you would impact the judgment of prosecutors and possibly hinder them or dissuade them from taking action. Now, Archer's attorney said this morning that they will appeal.
They will appeal. That was one of my questions.
Here's the thing. John Chisholm has made a number of enemies in the conservative community in Wisconsin because of the John Doe investigations. There was John Doe 1, which focused on Milwaukee County days for Governor Walker with his staff.
And resulted, Adelman said, in six convictions.
There's John Doe 2, which grew out of John Doe 1, and looked at coordination between Walker's campaign and conservative groups during the recalls. So that's a separate one. But yes, so now we're going back to, there will be an appeal, and the people who are behind this have deep pockets.
Yes.
So there are a number of people in Wisconsin who are unhappy about this entire thing and what happened with John Chisholm, and will not rest, if you will, until they feel like they've gotten their vindication with what he's done.
So Archer's lawyer said there will be an appeal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that closes our first lawsuit. But now, in a related, what the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to allow sealed documents mm-hmm. in the appeal of John Doe 2.
Yes.
But does that mean they're going to hear the case? That doesn't mean they're going to formally rule on it.
They're going to at least listen. What happened was that the state Supreme Court, recall, they shut down John Doe 2. All right? So you got to separate
the return
those
of materials and documents, everything collected in the investigation.
Said John Doe 2 was a bad investigation, that you are allowed to coordinate issue advocacy. Now, interesting side note, Adelman's decision yesterday said there's been no federal court that has ruled you can coordinate on issue advocacy between campaigns and outside groups, so there's that issue. But going to the Supreme Court, Chisholm and company has appealed, trying to appeal, the state Supreme Court ruling, saying essentially that it should have been shut down, and oh, by the way, Justice Prosper and Gableman should not have heard this case because they had a conflict of interest.
Yes.
Because they were aided by some of the same groups that are now involved in this investigation. So the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday said, okay, you guys can file these under seal.
Yes.
So we can see all this information and also be redacted copies in the public realm, if you will. So they're at least going to take a look. Now, there is no guarantee the Supreme Court will take it up. They take less than 1% of all appeals
filed
to them.
Let's be clear. Our U.S. Supreme Court has not agreed mm-hmm. to hear the appeal of John Doe 2.
They're just saying when you file this, we're going to look at this
under seal. That's important. Okay.
Yeah, but still, it's an important hurdle for them to clear in this process. At least they're going to take a look at it.
So. Okay. Now, that's the second legal mm-hmm. lawsuit we had to talk about. Now we need to turn to the federal court challenges against major initiatives enacted mm-hmm. by the GOP. So in the federal courthouse, two blocks from here.
Yes.
First, U.S. Judge James Peterson is presiding over the challenge to our photo ID requirement. J.R., here's my question. This has been, by the way, photo ID was signed exactly 5 years ago, years and 2 days ago. So photo ID has been litigated not only in Wisconsin, but across the nation. What new is being argued and is being litigated in the case before Judge Peterson?
This is, and the case actually goes beyond voter ID. It looks at things like the restrictions on early voting, the hours. So there are like a dozen laws, maybe half a dozen, that are being challenged.
All wrapped into this lawsuit.
But the most high profile has been voter ID. Now, voter ID for you and me is probably going to be here to stay. I mean, It's been upheld by the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. U.S. Supreme Court didn't take the appeal. So for people who have IDs, probably going to stick around. But the focus has become on the process where if you don't have an ID and you can't find the documents you need, like a birth certificate, to get an ID, there's a process in place now at the DMV to get it. The state Supreme Court, if you recall, in 2014, ordered the creation of this process because you've always been able to get a free ID under the ID law, but what if you don't have a birth certificate? You have to go pay for a copy of it.
Yeah.
Other documents you need, you might have to pay a fee. The state Supreme Court said that could be considered as a poll tax, if you will. So make sure you have a totally free process. Well, the appeal process, according to the people challenging it, is arbitrary and discriminatory against minorities, and therefore they're saying this is not proper. So the question becomes, what do you do if you are, for example, somebody who was born in the Jim Crow South and never got a birth certificate? What do you do to get your ID in Wisconsin? If you're born overseas, for example, I think one of the people who testified this week or was brought up in the trial was born overseas and their birth certificate was destroyed, I think, by Nazi Germany. I mean, what do? You don't have the documents you need. That becomes a question that they're diving into this lawsuit, plus there's also a separate challenge in federal court that also is touching on this issue of the appeal process or the application process for a free ID.
And this is why we noted last week that the Wisconsin Department of Transportation is now issuing receipts if you have applied for a photo ID.
Yeah, Walker's trying to clean up the process and make it more likely to withstand these challenges, or at least try to add some structure to the appeal process.
Okay, now Judge Peterson has said, I'm going to hear oral arguments at the end of June, and he has also said, therefore, my ruling could not upset the August 9th primary, right?
He's expecting it to be done by the end of July, but not enough time between that and August 9th to implement the changes. It's also likely going to be an appeal, so there's that other caveat out there as well.
Okay. Now let's talk about, there's a three-judge panel only two blocks away hearing a challenge to the reapportionment, which is the Senate and Assembly district lines that the Republicans drew in 2012. Here's my question. This has been litigated before, and the judges in Milwaukee said we're going to tinker around with two City of Milwaukee districts. Otherwise, it withstands on a math standpoint. So what's new in this case?
This is about pure partisan gerrymandering. It's not about the appeal that you're talking about. Well, the case you're talking about, they moved a line in southeastern Wisconsin to ensure proper representation or the opportunity for representation for Hispanic voters.
Yes.
Those challenges we've seen constantly in this country, whether it was not fair enough minorities or whatnot. This is about pure partisanship. And what they're saying is that if you go back in Supreme Court rulings in the past, four justices at one time said, there's no line you can cross for a partisan map. You are free to do what you want. Four justices said, yes, there is a line you can cross. And one, Justice Kennedy, who still is on the court, said, well, there could be a line, I just don't know where it is at. This is one of the first times we've seen a case go to trial where the plaintiffs are trying to set out a three-part standard to say that this is what the line should be. One is intent, not just that it was a partisan map, but a partisan map drawn so purely partisan, if you will, that it was meant to implement a durable and durable partisan advantage for a party. That's one piece of it.
Yeah.
The second piece is called the efficiency gap. Essentially, they're alleging that they're packing and cracking Democratic voters in the assembly lines. The packing is you put so many Dems in one district that it's overwhelmingly Democratic and you dilute their ability to influence other races because it's 90% Democratic, for example. The cracking is you dilute the Democratic voters into districts where it's 55% for, say, Republican, where they can't win no matter what and their votes are wasted, the efficiency gap. The third piece of the test would be there is no other way to justify the map. So, for example, let's say you have to draw a map in a certain way to meet the requirements of the Voting Rights Act or minority representation. If you are a state who has drawn a map that could be challenged, you would have this option, okay, we had to do it this way because of A, B, and C.
Mm-hmm.
That's a three-pronged test. The first thing is, will this three-judge panel say, yes, that test works for us? Then, if the panel says, yes, it works, then will it be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which is where it would go next? Will the court take it? Oh, by the court's 4-4. And when would this all happen? The plaintiffs want the assembly maps run out now. Well, we have a primary August 9th. What would that do? There are all these kind of ifs out there, but it could be kind of a chaotic situation in Wisconsin.
And let's turn that. I agree, and that's why we're talking about it, and that's why these are big deals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would seem to me that the federal judge could order relief in the photo ID case pretty cleanly. Mm-hmm. It changes X, Y, and Z. But if you're talking about the reapportionment case and the redistricting, we don't know if the three-judge federal panel agrees what they could order. Someone said in the Capitol that there's a Democratic legislator who said they could go back to the 2010 districts. I don't believe that.
Well, there are options. Republicans still control both House of Legislature and the governor's office. The Republicans could come back and draw a new map and just move some lines. The technology is so good now, you can draw, I mean, I don't say you can like instantaneously, but you can move some lines and address, meet the standard, if you will. Republicans could have that option if they wanted to. They could not appeal if. If the three-judge panel says these maps have a problem, Republicans could, and I'm trying to be as fat as possible, could draw a new map and say, hey, we met your standard, here's a new map, let's go.
But if the federal judges agreed, they could also say, look, we're within weeks of the November 8th presidential election. We're going to give you a date, February 1, to draw new lines and allow the current boundaries to be in place for the presidential
All
election.
All kinds of options out there.
Right.
Absolutely.
We don't know how the federal, but potentially these could be pretty big deals even for the August 9th and potentially might be, could be,
Candidates
November
8th. Candidates face a June 1 deadline to file their nomination papers.
We'll get to that in a minute.
So they have to do that. So imagine these guys have gathered signatures over a 6 weeks period for a district that could go away if.
I know. Okay, here's one thing that wasn't an if, a new subject. Dane County's Chief Circuit Court Judge Bill Faust ruled unconstitutional the right to work law. Well, our Justice Department, Attorney General Schimmel, immediately took it up to the Court of Appeals, and this week the Court of Appeals issued a stay holding Judge Faust's ruling in abeyance while the whole issue is litigated. Do I have this right?
Yes.
Okay.
So basically Thursday said the circuit court was, you know, within its rights the way it looked at the case, but it failed to meet a couple of standards, one of which is that the record did not support that there'd be harm to the unions, a significant harm to the unions,
right,
if they continued to represent these workers without the dues being paid. Because what Faust said was these guys are getting a free lunch, a free ride, if you will, that if you are working for a company under right to work and you're not covered by the contract, or you're covered by the contract, but you're not paying dues.
You're benefiting from the concessions in the contract.
You're getting a free ride.
Right.
And that's a problem. The third said, no, that's not a significant harm. What's more, the state has a likelihood of success on appeal. So we're putting this on, it just basically preserves the status quo, if you will. We've been operating since last year with right to work.
Yeah, and the chief presiding judge in Court of Appeals District 3, Judge Lisa Stark, said the state has established there is a sufficient likelihood of success, echoing the predictions of our attorney general, our governor, and Assembly Speaker Voss. Okay, well, one more lawsuit to talk about. So Attorney General Schimmel says, I'm joining 11 states trying to overturn the federal government's edicts on transgender bathrooms. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the same attorney general who, with the blessing and permission of the governor, has sued over the climate change, carbon emissions, and Obamacare. But now he's wading into the transgender, saying in his press release, the U.S. Department of Justice has told public schools to get federal aid. They must treat individuals according to their internal sense of gender. How do I feel, how do I identify with, male or female? And our attorney general said, I've decided to join 10 other states in challenging the Obama administration's latest power grab, which will have significant impact on Wisconsin. So what's, is this all politics or what?
Well, remember that DOJ now has a solicitor general that was created essentially to do this very thing.
Yeah.
Schimmel has been much more of the happy partisan warrior, if you will, than what J.B. Van Hollen was,
That's a
fellow Republican.
Term. I like that term, happy partisan warrior.
You know, he's definitely been itching for more fights with the Obama administration. Now, I mean, it's also a good issue for the base. Republicans don't, generally speaking, aren't real happy with this. The issue splits the public, according to the polls that we've seen. The carbon emissions, for example, are a big deal for Wisconsin because we're a big coal-burning state. So these kind of fit, if you will, in kind of his wheelhouse. But it definitely you've seen a change where he's more aggressive, if you will, on some of these issues than what Van Hollen had been.
Okay, I think this is the first lawsuit or judicial ruling we're talking about just in this show. And it reminds me of what Schimmel said at the Republican State Convention. You remember what he said? How a bill becomes a lawsuit.
Yeah. So, yes.
Okay, but now let's turn the corner. Let's talk about something that doesn't involve legal rulings and judicial decisions. Okay, the Democrats are preparing for their June 3, June 4 convention in Green Bay. Do you look for Sanders versus Hillary? to explode in some big way. We're not going to see any chairs thrown in Green Bay, are we?
I don't think so, because in talking to Martha Lane, the state chair, she's pointed out that their delegate process is done. They took care of that, you know, a few weeks ago.
48 for Sanders, 38, and then you have 10 superdelegates.
For Clinton, one for Sanders,
Thank
and
you.
Three who are not committed yet.
Right.
And so the process, her argument is the process has been more open and transparent, that they're not, it's not like you're going to convention like other states where you're fighting for delegates on the convention floor. This is a different situation. Now, there's going to be a resolution, for example, that's been brought up to debate on the floor on Saturday that says, next Saturday, that the party should back the abolition of the superdelegate system.
Yep, so get rid of the superdelegates.
There will be a chance for Sanders backers to kind of express their displeasure with what's been going on.
Yep.
But it's a non-binding resolution. Superdelegates are in the national party rules, so a state party non-binding resolution is not going to change the national party's mind about superdelegates. It could be a reflection where the state is, for example. There could be other resolutions brought up. You have until, I think, 3 p.m. next Friday to submit other resolutions that would come up from the floor. So there could be other expressions of, for example, the state's superdelegates should be apportioned according to the final vote of the statewide primary,
okay.
Something like that.
Okay.
But there'll be an issue. The question kind of becomes, are they going to rally against Donald Trump? You know, are they going to get past their feelings and rally against him? Remember, too, California's June 7th.
Yes.
We still have a couple of primaries to, or a couple of times to go. So it may be that Democrats are in the position that Republicans were a few weeks ago, where they're kind of coming to grips with the fact it's over and getting past that and moving on. It may take Dems a little bit longer to do it than Republicans, because they're still in the thick of things, even though as pundits, as people who cover this stuff, we're looking and going, okay, the math is there for Clinton to win. For the Sanders backers saying, well, she hasn't won yet, and we still have hope, and we're not giving up, and neither is Sanders, so there's still a little bit of raw feelings, if you will.
Okay, well, let's talk about the Friday schedule. We're going to hear from Congressman Kine, Congressman Pocan, Congressman Moore, hear from Russ Feingold. We're going to hear from Senate Democratic Leader Schilling, Assembly Democratic Leader Barca. So I think what you just said is they're going to focus on the call to unity, looking past the Sanders versus Clinton knife fight, right?
Yeah, it was also a vote on Saturday for the four members of the Democratic National Committee.
Which intrigues me. Why are there 12 people running for four slots on the Democratic National Committee?
I've talked to a few of them. I think there's just more interest. It's a presidential year. That's when the terms are. Now, here's a key thing. The four DNC members are superdelegates. The election will not change the math of the superdelegate contingent Wisconsin, because you don't take office until the conclusion of the Cleveland Convention.
Okay.
All right? So that's not going to change anything. But I've talked to a few people who are Sanders supporters who want to see change. The thing, though, is there's a difference between running and being organized to win. Jason Ray, for example, is a current DNC member. He's been on the DNC, I think, for two or three terms now, something like that. He knows the delegates. He knows how to appeal to them. He's sending stuff out. That's everything, just like showing up and giving a speech. So what I don't know is how serious all 12 are about running right now.
But Jason Ray is also uncommitted. He's mm-hmm. not said whether he's Sanders or
and
Hillary.
And has been getting grief on social media about not being committed with Bernie Sanders winning Wisconsin. So there's no upside for him, if you will, to backing somebody ahead of an election.
And one of the candidates for Democratic, there's two slots for Democratic National women on the DNC. Mm-hmm. And one of the candidates is State Senator Janet Buley, and I talked mm-hmm. to her, and she said, I want to bring the needs of rural Wisconsin, because she's, you know, way up in northwest Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm running for a slot on the DNC, because if you're on the DNC, you're automatically a member of the state party executive committee. So you don't see in the 12 candidates for four slots a mirror of the Sanders versus Clinton clash, do you?
There are some that I think who are playing up. There, for example, one I believe is trying to play up his ties, you know, his support of Bernie Sanders. But others I've talked to are not making it a Sanders versus Clinton issue. Now, there are some Sanders backers I've talked to who are talking about, I want to bring change to the party.
Mm-hmm.
I want to address these issues the party's not talking about. So there's some of that undercurrent. But as far as this is a Clinton versus Sanders contest, not that I've picked up yet, not that there might, isn't some of that there, but not an overwhelming kind of a sense that I get that's what's driving these races.
Okay.
Remember, it's two slots reserved for women, two for men. So six male candidates for two slots, six female for two slots.
Okay.
And Martha Love, former state chair,
she's seeking re-election.
Incumbent, yep.
But Christine Bremer in Wausau is not seeking re-election.
Nope. Yep.
Jason Ray,
seeking
re-election. And the fourth, he's from Door County, I believe, he's not seeking re-election.
Yes.
Okay. And you're going to be there doing a poll?
Oh, can't wait.
And Wisconsin I is going to be there streaming all the speeches. Now, you alluded to it earlier. Let's come back to the 5 p.m. Wednesday, June 1 deadline for candidates to file. That's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So what have you seen in the early filings that intrigues you?
Last time I looked, about a week or two ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, there were about a half a dozen Democratic lawmakers being challenged in primaries now.
Sandy Pope Roberts, Leon Young,
Lisa Subek, Jennifer Schilling has one. Now, what's interesting, though, is that, let's be honest, there's a difference between registering to run and filing the paperwork to run and being on the ballot. So that's the first hurdle, okay? In looking at the folks who are running, some of them I haven't been able to get in touch with. One said he is a Sanders Democrat, self-described Sanders Democrat, mm-hmm. challenging Lisa Subek because she's not progressive enough. In his mind, the Dane County delegation, the Democratic Party, is not fighting hard enough for progressive values. Now, I think the delegation would be surprised to hear that, but that is the only reflection I've seen of really truly a Sanders-Clinton type conflict. Lisa Subek was a Clinton backer, or is. Jennifer Schilling, for example, has a primary opponent, or somebody registered, who has some legal problems in his background and sees the race as a springboard running for the White House. Now, I'm not going to lie to you, I don't often see people challenge somebody in a Senate race and then go right from that to the White House, but that's part of what I saw in an interview in the Cross Tribune. So we have to wait and see what the final deal is.
Yeah.
Josh Zepnik down in southeast Milwaukee County, south side, he got a challenger not long after he got busted for drunk driving, so I don't know that that is a challenge purely on a Sanders-Clinton thing. It could be more about Josh's arrest. And oh, by the way, there's a significant Hispanic population in his district. The woman running against him is a Latina lawyer. There may be some more of that. So there are all kinds of issues going on right now, but not a clear common thread that I found just yet.
But the signs seem to be pointing to everything about this election year is unusual. Yeah. So this filing deadline, we're going to see some unusual things pop up.
Yeah, there is. I think Nancy Vandermeer, a freshman from Toma, she's the one Republican that last I checked who had a primary opponent registered. He was a private eye who wasn't happy with Madison, what's going on there. So, but again, can they get the signatures, get in their state of economic interest, and all that kind of good stuff. So that's still
If Vandermeer survives, that's going to be a rematch with former Representative Sue Vruwink, or do I have the districts wrong?
That's Amy Sue Rand. I don't know if Amy's running. I don't know who's running.
Maybe I'm wrong. Okay. All right, let's go to stock reports. Rising.
So David Bowen.
The vice chair of the party.
Bernie Sanders has an extensive, to say the least, list of national donors. He sent an appeal this week to eight legislative candidates. David Bowen is one. Now, here's an interesting fact. David Bowen is not opposed as of right now in his seat to re-election. His seat was won by President Obama with 89.7% of the vote in 2012. So he's not necessarily a top target this fall. What he is, though, is a superdelegate, and he backs Sanders. So maybe there's a little bit of kind of like a thank you, or this is a guy that I really can get behind because he got behind me. Now, I talked to Bowen this week, pointed out that what do you do with this money because you're not challenged. He said, look, if I get an opponent, it's one thing. If I don't, I can use the money to help like-minded Democrats. He cited, for example, a bill that Corey Mason supported this session to raise minimum wage to, I think, actually 10, to raise minimum wage to a living wage. So that's a bill that maybe is a litmus test, if you will. He talked about using money to support organizing efforts in some communities to turn out Democrats, so our progressives, and support people who are like him and Sanders and willing to shake up the status quo, if you will.
Well, okay, but a follow-up to that. Why did Sanders also set out a different press release saying, help my good friend Russ Feingold? What's the backstory there?
That, somebody told me, was smart politics because Sanders, remember, even though Bernie Sanders is not giving up on the race, he's got to be looking at the numbers going, okay, I'm not going to win. What's my exit strategy? What's my post-primary goal going to be? Well, one is influence the convention and the platform at convention. And two is to be a power player back in the Senate. He'll go back there. And this is a guy in Russ Feingold who, one, is a progressive, has a national reputation as progressive, is liked by the Sanders base.
Voted against the Patriot Act. Sanders reminded all the voters in his press release.
So, Russ has remained neutral in the primary, or not said who he supported in the primary. So, it's somebody can say, look, I'm a, it's a message to the players of, I can help fellow Democrats and not just be about myself.
Sanders also wants to change the game for how the presidential nominee is elected in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but mixed.
Scott Walker, so if, when you're governor, you are overanalyzed. Let's be honest about that. Governor Walker Monday said, well, I'm looking at running or making an announcement about 2018 after the budget is done. Well, just a month ago, we caught him at Ted Cruz's victory party at election night, and he said, well, I'll make an announcement after the 2016 election cycle. Well, now, it may be no big difference between that and the budget, but when you're the governor and it's not clear what you're going to do, you just send the chattering class into overdrive talking about, well, what's he going to do? What's this mean? Is it mean, like we've talked before, that Walker is trying to stay relevant because he's not going to run in 2018, but he knows the second he says he's not going to run, Republican lawmakers go, well, you're not going to be around anymore. We don't care what you think. We're going to do what's best for us. Is it that, or is he just like taking his time? I mean, it's just one of those things where even these things just get so analyzed, it's an issue. By the way, he's still about $900,000 in debt from his presidential campaign. Mm-hmm. A latest report came out over the weekend. We talked for that Monday morning. His fundraising has slowed. Walker's not been raising a lot of money from individuals, but what he has been doing is getting money from his list. He has a great fundraising list. There's a firm out there that just rents that list out to others. They use it. They pay him for using the list.
Yep.
It went from 127 to 128 in March to 70 in April. So if he's going to pay it off by the end of the year, like he said he has, he's not on pace to do it. His explanation is, well, once these races pick back up, the money will start coming in and we'll be okay. So we'll see about that.
Well, but also in terms of Governor Walker, when Donald Trump attacked the governor of New Mexico, the governor put on his, I'm vice chair of the Republican Governor yep. Association, issued a strong release defending the governor of New Mexico.
And got kudos from the Never Trump crowd, the conservative elite, saying this is what we're looking for, somebody who's willing to do this. Now, it also indicates, though, is one that Trump's having a hard time winning over some of those skeptical folks.
Yep.
And that there are people like Paul Ryan and Scott Walker who are not quite there. Well, Walker says he's going to support the nominee, but this is obviously a sign that he's not happy with the nominee at times. And also, the tightrope you walk as a Republican, we're trying to create space at times with your nominee about issues like that, because Susan Martinez is, oh, by the way, the most high-profile elected Latina in the GOP. Who's the GOP need? Females and Hispanics. And you're Republicans are just going, what is this guy doing?
She's a rising star like Nikki Haley.
Yes.
Falling.
So Rick Wiley.
Rick Wiley, hey, I've heard the name.
We got to go. We gave him props when he got hired by the Trump campaign after the implosion of the Walker campaign.
Yep.
Now he is... He has parted ways with Trump. The Trump campaign of statement said it was a temporary assignment, and the campaign's up and running, and now it's time to part ways. Well, you don't hire a national political director for a temporary assignment. The national media has reported that Wiley basically lost a turf war, that you have these two kind of camps in Trump world. One, the Trump loyalists who were there from the start, and now this kind of more professional operative class being brought in because they're going, okay, we need to start professionalizing this campaign and getting it to where we want it to be. Wiley was part of that wave coming in. He's the first one out. Now the question becomes after this, one, for Trump, do the rest of the national people, operative types, get pushed out? He sticks with what he knows. Two, where's Wiley land? You know, I mean, this is kind of like he now worked on the Walker campaign, which
for president.
Shot up to the moon, faltered and imploded, and he got criticized for overspending. He jumped on the Trump campaign at a perfect time and was with the nominee and got fired from that. You know, what happens to him? You know, it's politics. He's got a lot of ties with the RNC folks.
Yes.
Coming from that world, he'll probably land somewhere safe.
Yep.
But where does the Trump campaign go from here, and what's it say about how they're going to operate? Remember, they keep saying, I don't need analytics. I just need my rallies and my personality, and I'm going to be fine. And operatives will tell you that's not how it works in this world. But it is, it's a different world, and it's just a constant turmoil with Donald Trump, if you will.
Okay, so you don't think Rick Wiley quit out of principle having to shave that Fu Manchu thing?
There is a good chance that Rick Wiley had lost a turf war within the campaign. That's okay. The way it sounds like in national media, I'll put it that way.
All right. Okay, that's Rewind. I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.